when did this nightmare begin for you?
The day they arrested me on December 6th of 2000.
And what precipitated that arrest, as far as you can tell?
I still don't really have any specific idea of why it was they arrested me. It went from them accusing me of one charge to them accusing me of six charges to them dropping all of the charges because they were all garbage 2 years later. That the night they arrested me, they said it was for fraud, and that's basically all I knew at that time. They said, "You're being arrested for fraud." Those were the exact words that they used. It was it.
Where were you exactly arrested?
Downtown Toronto.
Did you have any warning that this might occur?
Well, actually, I had a piece of paper that had it on there that said something was going to happen to me and someone else, but it was in Russian, and that didn't. I did not go through the documents, didn't read them, so I was not positive exactly what was going on.
You have claimed in court that you are a member, or you're employed by the U.S. government. You're in naval intelligence. And can you explain to me what your job is as far as you're concerned, or what it was?
I was a courier.
Uh-huh. And you're working for the U.S. Naval Intelligence?
Yes.
I should say, just anecdotally, your family has a long history in U.S. Naval Intelligence. Maybe you want to tell us a little bit about that, just briefly.
My family's military history goes all the way back to the Civil War in the United States. My great-grandfather was about third in command in the U.S. Navy back in, around 1880, uh-huh. 1901, somewhere around there. I don't know the exact years. My father, he was in the military. My stepfather was in the military. My brothers were in the military. My whole family pretty much was in the military.
What brought you to Canada?
I came into Canada from Moscow.
And how long had you been in Moscow?
About 4 days.
And prior to that, you'd been in the United States?
No.
Oh, okay.
I went to Moscow from Sudbury.
From Sudbury?
Yes.
And how long had you been in Sudbury?
Just awaiting probably about a day.
Okay.
I didn't leave on an international flight.
Okay.
We were in private planes.
Private planes. All right. In Moscow, you had some contact with someone who is now deceased, Mark Bastion. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
Was that scheduled? Did you know that you were going to be meeting with this individual before you left Sudbury?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Your intentions here were what?
To pass a pouch off to an individual here in Canada. That individual would have brought that portion of the pouch to the people he worked for, and then I would have returned to the States with another portion of a different pouch.
Were you able to contact the person that you were supposed to hand this off to?
No, I didn't. That's why I never handed it off.
Right. And what did you do when you weren't able to hand this pouch off, or the contents of the pouch off?
I opened it.
Okay. Were you surprised by the contents?
I was a little bit shocked.
Uh-huh.
I would have thought that somebody would have explained to me exactly what it was that was in there. I knew some of the documents that were in there. I knew what they were, because I was sent there specifically for those documents. Some other documents that were in there were documents that were in wax seal envelopes, and I did not know what was in them, but I did open them at some time.
What did you think your next move was going to be?
Well, I was supposed to meet around the 5th, 4th and the 5th, and I went to meet with this person. There should have been two people there, not one. When I got there, there was only one person there. And the individual told me that Mark Bastion, who is now dead, and he was one of the individuals that I should have met, that he wasn't coming in until around Christmas time. So I was just to give the pouch to him. So what I did is I gave him a blank bag. It was just the pouch was the same pouch, but it had different documents. It had blank papers in it.
So was your feeling then that if you weren't handing it off to the person that you were supposed to be handing it off to, you weren't going to be handing it off to anybody?
Oh, exactly. That's
standard operating procedure, I suppose, as far as you're concerned.
I wasn't going to hand it off to somebody who had no right to have it.
Right. So, obviously, they received the pouch, looked inside of it. Whatever was supposed to be in there was not in there, and I imagine the search was on for you then, right?
Well, the search... I don't know if it started right then, right away. I know that after I passed off the dummy bag, I made a phone call to somebody and let them know what I did, and they exploded. And I set the meeting up again for the 6th, and I made it in a more public place where there were, you know, there were a numerous amount of people there. And that's when the fugitive squad from Toronto arrested me. But now, nobody knew where I was except for maybe two people.
Now, the person that you contacted that went ballistic when you told them what you had done or not done, were they in Canada or the United States?
Well, they're an American government official, but he is an American government official, but he's in Canada.
I see. They must have contacted the Toronto police.
Oh, they did.
The Metropolitan Toronto Police to apprehend you.
They contacted the Metro Toronto Police, we found out. I got orders to leave the first week of September. But when I got my orders, I wasn't supposed to leave until the last week of November. But I received my orders in September.
Uh-huh.
That was 2000. Mark Bastian received his orders and left on September 7th for Moscow.
Now, Mark Bastian, we should go into a little, just tiny bit of history here. Mark Bastian, or identification, he has been identified as a CSIS agent working out of Moscow.
Right, he works at the Canadian Embassy in Moscow.
Well, he did work. Now, when did you find out that not only would Mark Bastian not be returning to the country to meet with you, but he wouldn't be returning to the country alive?
I found out, well, I can't say that it was positive, but I wrote a letter to Mark Bastian around June of 2000 when I was in jail, and I sent it to CSIS headquarters, to the director, and asked them to have it couriered back to him. They got the letter, and someone came to see me, actually two people, two members of the RCMP NSIS. They came and saw me in August, and they told me that he was positively dead, but they had told my lawyers prior to that that he was most definitely dead. They never said he was murdered. They said that, I guess, he died of natural causes. So I found out in August of 2000.
Now, when they told you that he died of natural causes, what was your thought about that?
I told them right to their face, if he's dead, that's not what happened, that he was murdered.
And so now you're in incarceration now. The story then is that you are incarcerated here in Toronto. Where were you exactly?
Well, actually, they locked me up in the Don jail, but they transferred me to a jail up north and just left it. If anybody looked, basically everybody thought that I was in the Don jail. If you look at the articles that are spanning the globe right now, everybody says the Don jail, but I was not in the Don jail. I was in the jail up out by Lindsay.
And so your court dates, and how many court dates would you have had in the time you were incarcerated? How many times were you actually brought into a court of law?
Oh, geez. Probably. As far as the criminal charges go, I was brought to court actually 19 times, and they postponed every one of them. And then as far as the extradition goes, I was brought to court only when Paul Slansky was retained by me. And when I retained Rocco Galletti, I was just then they started bringing me into court for the charter application that I filed. And that was, I think they brought me to court 15 times over that from Lindsay.
How long does it take to get down there?
It was about, depending on traffic, I don't know how the Canadian or the Toronto traffic is. Maybe 2 hours, 2.5 hours each way.
Uh-huh.
Give the van an escort, an ATF escort both ways each time.
How long have you been employed doing this kind of work?
That specific kind of work since 1986.
Right.
Enlisted in July of 1984.
And have you had any trouble like this before?
Never.
Things go pretty smoothly, right?
Pretty smooth.
So now you're in Toronto, you're incarcerated, you're in Lindsay, and you're being dragged back and forth to court dates. Initially, from the reports that I have, you were charged with credit card fraud, using your own credit card, evidently, and which Mike Rupert finds funny.
So does the credit card company.
Yeah. And then there was a call by the U.S. government to have you extradited. What arm of the U.S. government demanded your extradition from Canada?
It was just a local government. The actual extradition request went through Washington, D.C. I know that for sure. It says so right on the document. But it's asking to extradite me back to Michigan for credit card fraud on a credit card that was given to me by the Navy. I mean, it's got my name on it. They're saying that it was fraud, that I committed fraud on the card, but American Express, on three different interviews that we had with them, which is on tape and part of the court record, says there is no fraud and that the card was issued to Lieutenant Vreeland of the U.S. Navy.
Now, the U.S. Navy, or an arm of the U.S. government, declared that you had nothing to do with them, that you weren't an employee of theirs, that you maybe had been employed at one time in the past, but that your claims were totally untrue.
Well, they refused to come to court. They would never come to court and say anything. What they did was they told the Canadian government verbally that I was not in the military. Then when we asked for, or they asked the Canadian government, the RCMP members of the Canadian Embassy in Washington asked the United States government for a copy of my military file. They just wanted to have it. The United States government told them, no, you can't have it. So I contacted the Congressional Liaison's office, which is in Tennessee, and I asked for a copy of it, and they have to give it to me. So out of 1,200 and some odd pages, they sent me 56 pages, and all of them were altered. They say that on their documents, it shows that I entered in November of 85, but I have letters that I wrote home to my mother from boot camp in July of 1984. We have the actual original envelopes. Mothers keep stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, she does. I was shocked, actually. I have photographs dated, you know, when you take a picture, the camera dates it dates the film, the exposure.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have photographs which are dated after their alleged date of discharge, which would have been March of 1986. Now, if I was only in the military from November of 85 to March of 86, why would I have a military file that is over 1,200 pages?
Mm-hmm.
And then why would they refuse to give up all of the pages? Why would they only come up with 56 pages out of everything? And even inside those documents, there are medical test dates and scores and stuff like that that are dated 1991. Now, they're trying to say that somebody in 1985 or 86 made a mistake and wrote 1991 on the document. I mean, that's impossible for anybody to believe.
Right. So they didn't want to go under oath anywhere.
They still won't.
Yeah.
Now the courts also told us. We filed a motion. We filed a motion asking them for disclosure, for discovery, as you call it.
Yeah.
Disclosure of whatever it is they have in the United States as far as evidence goes saying that I've committed a crime. The courts here said, no, you're not allowed to have that. We said, okay, let us call witnesses. They said, no, you can't do that either. So they want to charge me with a crime that I can prove didn't happen, but they don't want to let me call witnesses. They do not want to let me have any evidence that they allegedly say they have. And it's not right. Something's wrong with that. You don't do something like that.
So this was all going on, and I'm going to flash forward here to September 11th.
Go ahead.
And the World Trade Center attack occurs. Two planes go into the World Trade Center. Now, when did you find out that this had occurred?
First week of December. I mean, when did I find
out? No, when did you find out that it had actually happened?
That
you're
it
in
actually
jail.
Happened?
Yeah, you're in jail.
I saw it.
You saw it on television.
Yeah, the day it happened. I saw it the day it happened.
Okay, now, what happened after that, and this is why your case became a cause célèbre to a point, and I don't think the media jumped on it as much as obviously as they should have. They never hit the real stories. But you had warned of an attack of this nature. Is this correct?
Yes, I did.
When did you first warn someone? Who did you warn, and what was their reaction?
I first asked to speak to the Canadian military, or CSIS, on December 6th of 2000. I even put it down in writing. It's part of the immigration file. I asked to speak to them. They ignored me. In August, when the RCMP NSIS came, I told them to their face specifically about the World Trade Center. And my comment to them was, when someone bombs or someone nails the World Trade Center, I told them, I said, don't come back to me whining, asking me for information, saying I should have given you more when you're ignoring me now. Then what I did when they left is I was writing a memorandum to Vernon Clark, who's Chief of Naval Operations in the United States. I took a document that I had wrote, and I put it in an envelope. I sealed it, and the the government opened it up on September 14th, 2 days after, or 3 days after. And it was a specific individual who opened it because it was the same person that knew what was going on and the same one who had taken it from me. He's the one who opened it, and he was gone from work for 3 days. He opened the envelope up on the 14th. He read it, what was inside of it, and it was sealed in August, and he knew it. And they basically, they turned blue.
Did you know the date that it was going to happen, or did you just know it was going to happen?
I didn't know the exact day and time, no.
Did you know the month?
Yes.
When you were watching television every day as it head into September, were you watching for things developing?
No, I wasn't paying attention to it at all. I was basically, we were working on my own case. I knew something was going to happen in September. And I had just assumed that the United States, I mean, I'm not the only person out there. I know how many people are out there in the field doing what they're doing, so there were warnings coming from all over the place. I mean, we know today that there were warnings coming far and wide to the U.S. government. But basically, I can't say they were all ignored. They couldn't have all been ignored because FEMA was in New York on the 10th, not the 11th. And they're not just, FEMA might be in New York on a regular basis, but their task force is not set up for major catastrophe in any city, in any part of the United States at any given time.
Right. For our listeners, FEMA is the Federal Emergency Management Agency or whatever, right?
Right. And they were actually in New York the night before. They were set up for this. They knew something was going down. They just didn't know exactly how anything was going to happen. But they knew something was going to happen.
Yeah.
They definitely knew something was happening, but there are individuals that know exactly what was going to happen and when it was going to happen and how it was going to happen, and they let it go.
So this was unsealed, and as you say, they turned blue, and then what happened?
The letter went straight to Ottawa. It happened really quick. After that letter was made public, basically Rocco Galletti went and tried to speak with the Solicitor General of Canada. And he went up there more than once. He had a scheduled meeting with the guy. The guy blew him off. He ignored him. The RCMP were blowing it off. They were ignoring me before September and after. They knew. I told them to their face. They knew. They just didn't want to admit to anybody that they knew, that I told them, and that they just shrugged it off as, oh, the guy's a lunatic. After it happened, they really don't want to talk about it. They really don't want to say, oh, yeah, this guy, he's the guy who told us. You know, they don't want people to know stuff like that.
Right.
So my lawyers kept on trying to get the attention of the RCMP, of CSIS, and basically of Ottawa. And it wasn't happening. We took the charter app, or my lawyers put the charter application together, took that to them, gave them copies of everything we were going to say, and we let them know what I was going to file in court, and we let the U.S. government know what I was going to file in court. They basically just blew it off, so we filed it. Then Nick Prawn from the Toronto Star,
right?
He wrote an article.
Yes, I have it in front of me.
And after he wrote that article, it was while he was, the day he wrote that article, I don't remember exactly what Mr. Prawn said, but, and I'm not talking about in that article either, but there was a time when he spoke to the people from the U.S. Consulate's office, and after that article hit, the Secret Service was up there, the U.S. Consulate was up there. I've been bombarded with people saying, okay, what's going on?
When did they first try to extradite you?
That's the strange part. What they did is they contacted the Canadian government in November of 2000. And then what happened when I got arrested on December 6th, they didn't ask for extradition for 8 months. They didn't ask for anything until I started speaking out. That's when they filed for extradition.
What went through your mind?
They want me back.
Yeah,
they want me back, and they want me to shut up. I mean,
yeah.
I've I've had telephone calls from Captain Ritter, who works for JAG. I've got letters from members of JAG telling me that I was violating certain, like, Code 14s or authorizations to testify in court of law. Any government or military personnel who testifies in a court of law to anything in open forum must have permission prior to doing so from JAG. It's called Code 14. It's under USCA 725-1 and through 725-11. And it basically, it was a threat. If I open my mouth, I'm going to go to jail. But they're not putting that on the record in court. They're just sending it to me. I have letters from other members of JAG in the California sector saying that this discharge that you see that is inside the file they sent, if you notice, there's no signatures on any of your documents. No one's ever discharged you. Being absent from the military without proper discharge authorization would constitute me as being AWOL and a crime. I've got those types of actual letters from JAG. I've got phone calls from Captain McCarthy, Captain Ritter. I've got phone calls from 20 different legal people from JAG in the military. I've got phone calls from the Secret Service and other individuals, and I've taped all of them. I mean, I wasn't taping them. They were leaving messages on a voicemail that I have, is what they were doing. It's just so ridiculous. It's not even funny. It's just so hard to explain it. Whoever is doing what they're doing, they're stupid at what they're doing. They're constantly tripping over their own feet.
Tell us about this amazing thing that happened in open court, the phone call that occurred.
What happened is my lawyer asked me, is there any way to prove anything at all that we can show the court right now to prove that you're a member of the military? And I said, well, you can always call the Pentagon and ask. And Kevin Wilson, the Crown, he, you know, had a fit. Oh, that's not proper, blah, blah, blah. Justice McDonald said, you know what? He goes, if he calls the Pentagon and they verify, he goes, I want to hear this. Basically, the judge was just, if I want to hear what's going on. So my attorney, Paul Solansky, went and bought a speakerphone, actually, and he plugged it into the courtroom. He called Information in the United States and asked for a number for the Pentagon. The operator that he called is just a regular operator, 1-555-1212. You ask for the number for the Pentagon in the United States. They give you a telephone number which links you to the Department of Defense operator. He got through to the Department of Defense operator. He was transferred through to the Pentagon operator. He asked the Pentagon operator if she could find my office. She said yes. She verified who I was, that I was a lieutenant in the U.S. Navy. She verified what office I was in. She verified the phone number to that office. And she verified that it was active, I was current, at the Pentagon. And this was all in open court, and it's part of the court record. Then they come back a month later and try to cover it up.
Who tried to come back?
Well, Kevin Wilson. This is not his doing, though. I'm not going to say this is Kevin Wilson's doing. Somebody came back a month later. They postponed on that day for the Christmas holiday. When we came back to court after the Christmas holiday, the local Michigan sheriff writes a letter. All right, not the United States government, as stated by Kevin Wilson. He says that they contacted the U.S. government. But a sheriff in a small town in Michigan does not constitute a member of the United States government. He's exactly what he is. He's a small town sheriff. He's a nobody. They contact him. He made a phone call according to him. We can't verify what he's done, but he comes up with a 3-page memorandum saying that I had called the Pentagon from jail and tricked the Pentagon operator into putting my name on the telephone directory, then listing me as lieutenant, picking a specific room in the Pentagon, which happens to be an OPNAV room. I'm not going to say what room, but he's saying that I did all this over the telephone from jail. And then he's saying that I also sent an email to the Pentagon from jail. And he produces this as evidence, a copy of an email, which is not even an email. You can look at it and you can tell it's not an email. And he says that's how my name got listed on there, that I had tricked them. I tricked the United States Pentagon into listing me as an officer in the military and giving me my own office in the military and my own phone number in the military in the Pentagon.
They were sort of, weren't they intimating that you'd hacked into the military and that you had changed the files? You had this ability to change the files at the same time as saying that you were a low-level functionary and you really didn't know that much?
They contradicted themselves twice, sure. First, I was too stupid to be the person that they would send to Moscow to check out the technology. And then they come back saying that I had tricked the people at the Pentagon, and someone has made the comment that I hacked into the computers at the Pentagon and changed this stuff. The problem is I'm in jail. I don't have a computer, and the specific computers that he's speaking on that he knows nothing about are not even online. You can't hack into something that's not online. They're stationary computers. They're not online.
Can you just tell me what the look on the people's faces were and what your demeanor was when this phone call went through and the Pentagon says that you actually have that you have an office there?
It was very silent in the courtroom. The judge, they recessed right after that happened. Kevin Wilson basically, he had no composure at all, none. He didn't say anything. He didn't do anything. He just objected to it being entered into evidence. He basically wanted to find a way, as soon as he could, to discredit the phone call. That was the only thing on his mind, was discrediting that phone call. I don't know if I can go as far to say that Kevin Wilson was trying to just discredit it, or if he was trying to find out if the phone call was real and if I was telling the truth. I believe he was just trying to discredit me, because there was so much evidence that I did have, that we did offer up. And he came up with some Alice in Wonderland theory every time my lawyers put something to him. It's like they're living in Disney World. These things just do not happen. You don't hack into the Pentagon computer system when it's not online. And you don't call the Pentagon from jail, collect, or on a three-way or however, and convince somebody at the Pentagon to put you on that computer system. It doesn't happen that way. You know, it just doesn't happen. That's all I can say, is it doesn't happen that way.
So were you surprised that when that call was made that they actually had you still on the list?
No, I wasn't surprised at all.
Why?
Because I knew I was still on the list.
Would you think that one of the first things that they would do if they had a concern about you would be to remove you from that list?
Sure. If you try very, very hard to completely annihilate somebody's existence, If you try too hard, you're going to screw up. I mean, when people start to do things like that, they're going to make a mistake somewhere.
Yeah.
They're going to make some type of mistake somewhere. The high school records in the military record are wrong. It says inside the military record that they sent up here that my employment prior to the military was tool and die when I was 13 years old. It says that I was a cook at some company when I was 12 years old, and it's ridiculous. You know, it says that kind of thing inside that file. there's so many inaccuracies inside the files that they sent. It's the fact that they didn't remove me from that system out there is not shocking to me. And when the Pentagon got hit, if they changed systems and would say they went back to an old system, because their new system from, I don't know who owns, I think Verizon set up the new system. If their new system was hit and went down and they went back to the old system, I would still be in the database from the old system.
Yeah.
They're saying that I'm definitely not there now. I'm saying, well, I'm sure they've removed me now. I'm pretty positive they have, but it's too late now because we have it on court record.
So you're out of jail now. When did that happen?
March 15th.
So just about a month ago.
Yes, almost a month.
And on what terms were you released?
$5,000. Had to tell them exactly where I was living. No weapons. I have to report once a week, every Monday, to somebody.
Uh-huh.
And then I have a curfew.
And the charges are still active?
Well, the criminal charges that they had in here in Canada?
Yes.
No, them are gone.
Those are gone. So
they've dismissed those completely. They actually didn't even show up to court when they were supposed to on three different occasions for us to fight those charges. They didn't even come in because I won't speculate on why they didn't show up.
Yeah.
I can just say that they didn't show up and then they withdrew the charges.
Now, those charges were what?
It was fraud, threatening death. I think there was an obstruction of justice charge in there. There were five different charges. I don't know. I tell you the truth, I don't know exactly
what
they
were. Were they all related to things that happened in Canada, or did it have anything to do with what had occurred in the supposed charges out of Michigan in the United States?
It had nothing to do with the charges in the United States. There was, someone had said that I was charged here in Canada with credit card fraud here in Canada also. That was not true. I'm not going to say who printed it or who did it. If somebody sees it, that's fine. I'm not bashing the guy for doing it. Someone gave him wrong information, and he printed it that way. But there were no credit card fraud charges in this country.
Did you know about the September 11th, or what would eventually happen in September 11th, or this general idea about a building being hit by an airplane or by something? Was that information that you found out about because you opened the pouch?
Yes.
Was it seen as being a concern of those that were in the pouch? In other words, is this something that they had foreknowledge of something happening, like that they or a suspicion that something was going to happen?
There's one letter in there. There's one document that I don't know if it's actually public document, but I know we gave it to the government. Which specifically speaks on September 11th. Doesn't say the 11th. I don't think it says specifically the 11th. But it says September, and it talks about something happening to the World Trade Center, specifically between two different governments. It was a communication from one government to another one,
now,
letting them know what was going to happen.
Now, the material that was in the pouch that you held up until that day where you were apprehended on December 6th of the year 2000... were you in control of those documents when you were apprehended?
Absolutely. When I was apprehended, I didn't even bring them with me.
You didn't bring them with you?
Nope. On the second meeting, I didn't bring them at all.
When the police apprehended you, you didn't have the material with you?
Nope.
So where's the material now?
It's in Canada.
It's in Canada somewhere?
Yes.
Is it in control of the authorities?
No.
So only you know where it is?
I won't say that. No, I'm not the only one who knows where it is.
Okay.
That would be dumb for me to do
that way. Yeah.
My lawyers don't know, and no member of the Canadian government knows. No one in my family knows, but there is one person who knows where the stuff is at.
And
the originals.
Did the court ever ask for that to be brought in?
Yeah, they did. Justice McDonald basically said it was an adverse inference he was assuming against me because I refused to give them the documents. And my only answer to that is that's the whole problem. This whole issue is over these documents. So I'm supposed to give them to this court? So what? The court can seal them and hide them?
Uh-huh.
Exactly what would happen. I'm not saying Justice McDonald would do anything wrong. I'm saying that's what would happen with the documents. It would be out of his control before he had a chance to get it in his control.
So, how insistent are they that you provide these documents?
They want the documents.
Uh-huh.
I mean, even though they're saying they don't exist, they still call me and tell me, you know, I have somebody that called me from the Secret Service asking me to call him, this is why I was in jail, to call him so we could arrange to have the documents picked up. And he leaves this message on my voicemail with his telephone number. You call it and you ask for them. He's a Secret Service agent. They answer Secret Service, you know, so on and so forth. But the documents are safe. I don't know what all of them are because I did not open every page.
Uh-huh.
I did not open everything. I opened the majority as much as I could in the time frame that I had. But they're here and they're safe. They're not with me. They're not in my apartment or anything like that.
Let's say that these charges, the extradition request, the charges in Michigan are dropped. What are your plans now? I mean,
I'm going to bring the documents public. That's the best thing for me to do is to bring them public, because you can't let something like September 11th happen and then hide the truth of what really happened, who was behind it, and who had knowledge of it, the fact that it was going to happen, and let them get away with it. Let them get away with not doing something about it.
Uh-huh.
They could have stopped it. They could have stopped those planes.
Right.
And anybody who says that they couldn't have is a liar. Anybody who believes that government officials in the United States did not know. If they believe it just because they don't want to believe it, that's the only reason they believe it, is because they don't want to believe it. Because they knew. The United States government, someone in there knew what was going on. I'm not giving anybody's name. I'm not saying anyone specific. I'm just saying they knew. They knew what was going on. And they did nothing about it. Same thing with Roosevelt. Look what Roosevelt did. I mean, he let him bomb Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Just so he could get involved in the war. He knew it was going to happen. And people don't find out that, you know, for 20, 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
No? So it's the same issue. If Roosevelt can do it and get away with it, why can't somebody else? I mean, it's the charges in the states and the record in the states, the criminal stuff, it's just fraud. The naval record, it's fraud. They know it. I know it. And it's going to come out eventually. It's not going to be hidden forever. It's going to come out in the courthouse. It's going to come out on the regular press. It's going to come out the mainstream media.